Okay, so this evening is our Saturday night gathering as well as our Lunar Observance night gathering, one part gathering. And once in a while, happens to be coincide. And it's also the last opportunity for me to give a Dhamma talk on to the assembly. I mean, I'll be here for a few more days, but I'll be gone before the next Saturday or Lunar Observance Day. So I'll be away for, of course, first to Thailand and doing teaching and leading retreat and retreats and visiting different monasteries and teachers. That's sort of my annual visit to Thailand. But then after that, then I'll be going to England, to Amaravati, where I've actually never stayed for an extended period of time. But that's on the invitation of Ajahn Amaro. Invitation, request, plea to help be a bit of an anchor. He's going to be away for a year, so the next year I'll be at Amaravati. So a bit of an adventure, bit of an adventure for an old man. And so this evening, sort of pondering what to bring up for contemplation in this talk, and I mean, I keep circling around Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. It's, I've been, over these last, particularly this last month, but over these last many months, I've been reading a series of talks that I gave 2005 on mindfulness of breathing. It was during a winter retreat. I guess winter retreat 2005, and we started a winter retreat as usual, and decided, okay, well, what do you start talking about? Start talking about meditation. So then it sort of drifted into 19 talks on mindfulness of breathing, which is a favorite subject of mine, But I've been, and so anyway, and people have been asking for years for it to be put into a book form. And over the years, various people have transcribed and then kind of done some editing on these talks. And Debbie's been coordinating a lot of it. And then, you know, kind of leaning on me to take a look at it and see if I approve or what do I feel about it. And normally I can't bear to read my own teachings, but this seemed important. And it took me a while to get momentum, well, to even do anything, actually. But then I sort of realized, well, no, people do want to see this, so I should be putting forth the effort. And so I have been reading them and giving my comments and doing some corrections. And so I think at some point in time there will be a book show up. And I think all in all the talks hold together pretty well. Of course, it's 20 years ago, so you know I do have a bit more experience now. So that too, I think one of the things that is probably important to reflect on, thinking about Anapanasati, thinking about meditation in general, but my particular preference in practice has been mindfulness of breathing. The Buddha himself, of course, praised it a lot. Of course, one of the well-known times when the Buddha went into a 3-month retreat, and didn't go an alms round, Ananda would bring his meal for him. And after the Buddha had been in retreat for quite some time, he asked Ananda, you know, what would you tell people if people ask, you know, what's the Tathagata, what's the Buddha doing while he's in retreat? How would you answer? And of course, the Buddha deferred to, said, well, to the Buddha himself giving the answer. And then the Buddha said, well, you can tell him that he's doing anapanasati, he's doing mindfulness of breathing. So that if it's good enough for the Buddha, for his retreat time, it's good enough for all the rest of us. And of course, the Buddha does praise it as, or is praised in the tradition as being a meditation that is suitable for all different temperaments, and we can all benefit from mindfulness of breathing. And we can use it in conjunction with other methods and techniques and whatnot. Certainly the, you know, Brahma Viharas, it's an easy mix, it's an easy fit to help. Like using the Brahma Viharas as a lifting up of that, so the bright states of loving kindness, of compassion, in particular, but you know, sympathetic joy or equanimity, these divine abidings, and using that as a kind of a transition to move into the breath. Or the opposite is true, as we develop the mindfulness of breathing and using the mindfulness of breathing to, you know, kind of slide into these bright states of these divine abidings. And certainly the use of insight and investigation and contemplation, it's not just put your mind on the breath and shut up and sit there, wait for things to happen. You're in the Buddha's path, and you're always trying to turn the mind. And certainly Ajahn Chah's encouragement, really turning the mind to investigation, contemplation, reflecting on just the nature of experience, impermanent, unsatisfactory, non-self nature of experience, and so that the sense of settling and stilling the mind, and then using that settled place to reflect and investigate, because that's when it really penetrates the heart. Well, it's interesting in the Abhidhamma, the description of definition of samadhi is non-wavering, which is a really interesting. Okay, so try the non-wavering of the mind. And how do you interest the mind so that it doesn't waver, and so that using the breath and then using investigation, that's for samadhi to really settle, to unify, and to really be stable. Having a steady, soothing object is really helpful. So mindfulness of breathing, and it's just paying attention to what is there. It already exists. You don't have to create the breath. You don't have to conjure it up as an object of attention. It exists, and you can pay attention to its characteristics. But also just in terms of just meditation in general, because sometimes the path gets, and the Buddha's teachings sometimes get, especially in the West, certainly not so much in the Asian traditions, but it can be, you know, Buddhism can be equated with meditation or equated with mindfulness practice and thing. Well, no, it's much, much broader, much deeper than that. And, you know, paying attention to how do we begin our practice with, say, a particular quality of faith. I mean, just having enough faith to start a meditation practice is not a small thing. But how do we nurture a quality of faith? Because if mindfulness of breathing just becomes a rational intellectual project that we're embark on to make the mind a little bit more peaceful, I mean, that'll work. It'll help. But it won't really transform, I don't think. I think it's important to be lifting up the elements of their recollection, you know, having a refuge, in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And in particular, the recollection of the Buddha as an enlightened, awakened being who taught a truth that was true 2,500 years ago, and of course is still true today. Truth is truth, and truth does have a power to transform. You know, and this is when the Buddha speaks of like spiritual faculties or spiritual powers, faith or santa. Faith is it's actually not a great word in the English language because all of its connotations in our culture, but you know, more like confidence or a devotion. It's not just believing in something, it's a feeling uplifted and confident in this truth that the Buddha pointed to, and the presence of that truth as something that we can, that is accessible to us as human beings. And there's a certain kind of spark or aliveness that comes with saddha that is really important. And you know, and I think for most of us, it's not easy to have that kind of saddha. I know for myself, in terms of my temperament and my personality and my own background, faith was not much of an option to begin. My personality is conditioned by kind of doubt and worry. I mean, that was the go-to option rather than faith or confidence in anything. And so everything was doubted. Everything was a source of worry or concern or anxiety. And that, you know, you can't really get very far on a spiritual path with that as a basis. But, you know, it also, how do you say, a motivator or a generator of dukkha. And you know, when you're miserable, you want to look for a solution. You're looking for a way out. And then there's the Buddha's teaching. And then, of course, I had the incredible, great, good fortune of having Ajahn Chah as my teacher, who was a constant bright light of, here's an example of the fruits of the practice. So that being able to commit to the practice and the training, and so that faith slowly arose. But one needs to nurture that and look after it and care for it and use it skillfully so that that faith is a generator of effort. I mean, that's the five spiritual faculties: saddha, virya, sati, samadhi, panya. Confidence, saddha, virya, effort, energy. One has to put forth effort. One has to try this, try that, experiment with this. Put some time and energy into this. And then just the quality of mindfulness, because you know, the bringing the mind, placing it into the mode of recollection and presence, being present rather than being scattered, and then directing that mindfulness to the basis of our experience is this body and mind, and which four foundations of mindfulness: body, feeling, mind, objects of mind, phenomena, which is, of course, that's your That's your basis of mindfulness of breathing. When the Buddha teaches those 16 steps of the four tetrads of mindfulness of breathing, there follow that template of those four foundations of mindfulness. And then, settling, that samadhi, non-wavering. It's such an important quality to be attending to, not forcing the mind into a place of perceived samadhi, but figuring out what the mind responds to in a way that it's willing to settle and to not waver. And you have to learn how to look after the mind. And that's one of just having those many tools of anapanasati, many different approaches. Because it's not just a step-by-step, cookie-cutter type of go to start step one, end up step 16, and you meet, and you sort of like you reach your goal. And there's a lot of, you just have to figure out what works at what particular time. And it's quite, it's very broad, as is the nature of our mind. It's so diverse. We can think of anything, and we have to learn how to understand that. So that the sense, and of course, banya, wisdom, discernment, is seeing clearly, and being able to use the mindfulness of breathing as a support for seeing clearly. It's not just trying to force the mind into a place of stillness. It's strengthening. It's like Ajahn Chah saying, for us as human beings, if you want to have a strong body, you've got to do all sorts of different exercises and activity, and then to strengthen the body. But to strengthen the mind, the heart, citta, you've got to learn how to make it still, make it settled. And so that bringing the mind to a place of non-wavering, of settledness, stability, then it can see more clearly. And that the way we relate to the practice and relate to the mind, and so often we just sit down, okay, I'm going to do mindfulness of breathing. I'm sit down, try to force the mind on the breath. And so, it's not a bad start, but it's not going to satisfy. It's going to, it'll be frustrating after a while because the mind's really slippery. And so just trying to force the mind onto an object. So one of the images I like to use is just, rather than trying to put the mind on the breath, how do I fill the mind with the breath? So breathing in, I'm filling the mind with the breath. Breathing out, filling the mind with the breath. And so it's a different feeling. It's a different experience. And it's you're still breathing in or breathing out, but the feeling is much more expansive, more replete, and it's not so willful. It's just being able to trust in that process of awareness, of mindfulness. I think one of the things over time, my own, Krista, the whole process of that using the 16 steps to anapanasati and learning how to be flexible and agile in when and how to use those different steps at different times. I mean, that there's a skill that grows over time because you become more familiar with the process and with the mind itself. But also there's, to me, I think what's just as a certain simplicity in maybe distilling what's the essence. Because it's just, the process is, there is this I mean, even the Buddha himself, I can't remember what the sutta is, when it's there, where the Buddha is talking about using the practice, contemplating, and the five aggregates, the six sense bases, as impermanent, as unsatisfactory, as not self, and just you see the conditioned nature of all phenomena. And in that seeing of the conditioned nature of all phenomena from all these different angles and perspectives, and then just turning the mind to the deathless element, the Amata Dhatu, and you think, the shift is so simple. And then, but also then, how do we experience that? How do we even conceive of the deathless element? That's where you're taking experience beyond words and concepts. But it's still an experience, because what you experience, it tends to be peace, tends to be spaciousness, tends to be a freedom, a liberation, a relief, a release from the things that bind us to suffering. So and this is something, certainly see that these days with Lopa Samedho. He's moved back to Amaravati a few years ago now, and he's been giving talks quite regularly, just about every week, if his health is good. And he's pretty relentless in his just wake up. Wake up, be awake. Be the one who knows. this comes at it from so many different angles. He's so articulate, but in essence, that's what he's keeps pointing to, and that's sort of the culmination of his experience. And I think that that's something that the Ajahn Sumedho point to, is just the essence of this path is just like the example of the Buddha knowing the Dhamma. Or the one who knowing the way things truly are. It's a beautiful way to express that and say, what are we doing when we're sitting meditating? What are we doing when we're keeping the precepts? What are we doing when we're doing our daily chores? Being the one who knows, seeing the way things truly are. And just not getting too lost, not getting too confused, not getting too tangled up and our own kind of dramas and biases and proliferations. Just learning how to be the one who knows, being the one who is awake, this Buddho. Because certainly in northeast of Thailand, and that's a primary meditation technique, is just a recitation of Buddho. And again, you've got to start questioning that. You use it as a technique in conjunction with the breath, but then also you've got to, who is this one who knows? What is this one who knows? What is this this one who's awake? Because that is the kind of the definition of Buddha in Thai, sort of translated with not just one term, but just one who knows, one who's awake, one who's radiant, puru putu pubarkbat. And this is a very beautiful description of what the quality of the Buddha mind is, the Buddha heart. And it's what the Buddha himself is. Of course, there's a very beautiful sutta, the Dona Sutta, where Dona the Brahman is walking in the countryside, sees his footprints in the dust just seem to have special markings on the footprints. And he follows it. He says, what is this? This is not an ordinary human being. This is not And he follows the footprints and sees, what he sees is the Buddha sitting underneath a tree, sitting meditating, peaceful, serene, bright. And he comes up to the Buddha and pays homage to him and asks him, you know, are you a deva? And the Buddha says, no. Oh, are you a Gandhava, a celestial being of some sort, some special? And the Buddha says, no. Are you a yaka, some kind of powerful kind of god type, demigod? And the Buddha says, no. Are you a human being? He says, no. And of course, the one of them, well, what are you? And the Buddha says, he said, Buddho Timangarehi. He said, remember me as awake. Remember me as awakened. Or remember me as, consider me to be the Buddha. So it's just, you know, all that I, and then he actually says, you know, whatever tendencies or proclivities I had to be, and asavas that I had to be a deva or a yaka or a gandhava or a human being have all been relinquished by me. Know me as one who is awake. And so we all have that possibility. We all have that capacity. But, you know, and that's where the tools of anapanasati are so. Because we need the tools to, we can't just sort of, oh yeah, nice idea, we'll be awake. You know, good luck. We need to have the tools of practice that help us live this path, live this truth, live this, really experience that sense of being the one who knows the way things truly are. And, you know, I think one of the, I think of the teachings of Ajahn Mun. Ajahn Chah talked about receiving instructions from Ajahn Mun. And also in listening to other or reading the biographies of other disciples of Ajahn Mun, there was a theme that he emphasized in giving instructions is know the difference between the mind and the objects of mind. There is this knowing, there is the objects of mind, where the mind goes out and of course, once it goes out, it gets entangled. If one's able to come back, really be present with this quality of knowing without it getting tangled up with its moods and its impressions and its proliferations, it has this possibility of release. And so then being able to encourage that, and of course, you know, the tools of anapanasati are, you know, really important tools to be able to learn how to use. I mean, all the different practices that are part and parcel of the Buddha's way are important, but of course, well, I have a particular bias, but I think the Buddha himself put a lot of emphasis on this teaching. And it's also like, because what one's seeing is that it doesn't have to be all that special. It's like Lumpu Mun in his ballad of the liberation from the khandhas. It's like the kind of the essence of insight, of liberating insight. Saying, the Dhamma stays as the Dhamma, the khandhas stay as the khandhas, that is all. It's really beautiful. It's just this, you know, there is this fundamental truth of the way things are. There's our khandhas that, you know, crank stuff out all the time and get old and sick and die on the physical realm, on the mental realm. We, you know, there's stuff happening all the time. Can't really stop that, but you can know the Dhamma as the Dhamma. And in seeing that, there is peace, there is release. And there's also a very beautiful exchange or conversation that Lumpu Dun has with, there's a couple of senior monks, and of course there's the monk who overheard it, who reports it, who writes it down. Lumpudun wasn't much of a writer himself. He was a very simple monk who was exceptional. Of course, he's the one who had that formulation of the Four Noble Truths in a unique way that I think also a very important tool for our practice. But there's these two monks that come to visit Lumpudun, and they were senior enough, and they had lived with various teachers in the northern part of the Isan. Lumpudun lived in the very southern part of the Isan. He lived along the border of Cambodia. Anyway, they're talking about this monk and this great teacher and their kind of attainments and where they dwell in this level of samadhi, or this monk dwells in this level of attainment of the Brahmaviharas, and so he has a lot of disciples, or he dwells in this abiding of a peace, so that he's always kind of safe and protected. And of course, the monk who's reporting that is a very lively and really fascinating kind of discussion. But Lumpudun isn't really discussing; he's sort of listening to these monks go on. And finally, he says, "Well, whatever level a monk has reached, as far as I'm concerned, they're welcome to dwell there. As for me, I dwell with knowing." And then all of a sudden, the monks are very, very quiet. Lumpu, what is the knowing? What does it mean to dwell with the knowing? And Lumpudun answered, knowing is the normality of the mind that is empty, bright, pure, having stopped all fabricating, stopped searching, stopped mental motions, completely released, having let go of not hanging on to anything at all, something like that. And so it's just this incredibly beautiful description of what this path has the possibility, but it's not, and on a certain level, it's not that exciting. It's not that, it's not that quote unquote special. And Lumpudun as a presence, he was just this incredibly peaceful presence, as opposed to displaying some special powers of something or special personality. But he was really, just the normality of mind that's empty, radiant, pure. And it's just stopped all its searching and seeking. And it's this having let go, having released. So this is really what, when we speak of mindfulness of breathing, yes, you do all the steps. Yes, you do all the preparation. Yes, you do all the, put forth the effort. But you always have to remember what it's for. What's its purpose? What's the goal? And the goal is not far away. It's just the Dhamma is the Dhamma, the Khandhas are the Khandhas. You know those Khandhas, know the Dhamma, and don't get entangled. Or just one who knows seeing things as they truly are. Don't offer that for reflection this evening.